From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. President Trump, just back from the G20 summit in Buenos Aires, is touting a trade truce with China.
It'll have an incredibly positive impact on farming, meaning agriculture, industrial products, computers, every type of product.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo meeting with his Mexican counterpart. Former FBI Director James Comey heads to Capitol Hill to testify. And a shutdown showdown shelved for now. The president backing a two-week government funding extension and delaying a fight over funding for his border wall. This hour on Point, looking ahead at the coming week in the news. Join us. What did you take away from President Trump on the world stage at the G20? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, two presidential historians will join us to remember the 41st president of the United States, George H.W. Bush, who died Friday night at the age of 94. But first, three top reporters open their notebooks for us to sketch out what's ahead in the coming week. With us from Washington is Darlene Superville. She's White House reporter for the Associated Press. Darlene, great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's our great pleasure. Also with us from Washington is Jeff Begays, Justice and Homeland Security correspondent for CBS News. Jeff, great to have you back.
Hi, Anthony.
Hey there. And with us from Washington as well is Dave Lawler, associate editor of World News at Axios and author of Axios World Newsletter. Dave Lawler, great to have you as well back on Point. Welcome.
Great to be with you.
So I'd love to start. We're going to be talking later in the hour about President Bush, the late President George Herbert Walker Bush. Over the weekend, he died. His body will lie in state this week in the Capitol. I'd love to just get a quick thought from at least a couple of you. Jeff Begays, let me start with you. How are you thinking of the 41st president? What mark did he leave?
Well, he left several marks. And I think as a one-term president, people perhaps forget that. But, you know, the fact that he supported and signed into law the Clean Air Act, I think that's the kind of legislation that a Republican today could not get behind. The fact that he helped oversee the passage of the Americans with Disabilities Act, that's another piece of legislation that I think in this Washington would not perhaps get the bipartisan support that it saw back when he was president. Also, you know, he was a man of character, and I think most of the people or anybody who knew him, who dealt with him, feels that way. And then those of us who didn't know him personally but just see how he interacted with his family over the years and how his kids just adored him. You know, for those of us who are parents, I think, you know, to see that, it serves as a form of inspiration. So he definitely left a mark, and I think, you know, people who see and reflect on his life today see a different Washington back when he was president than we see today.
Yeah, Darlene, I want to ask you, as someone who's covering the White House of today, I'm sure you've been thinking about that different Washington that President George Herbert Walker Bush represented back in his day.
One of the things that strikes me the most when I think about H.W. is just the breadth of experience that he brought to the White House when he was elected president. He had served in the Navy. He went into the oil business, so he had some business background. He served in Congress. He was chairman of the Republican Party, the Republican National Committee. He was ambassador to China. He was director of the CIA. He was vice president for 8 years before he was elected president. And you contrast that with some of the politicians today who seem to be born and then tomorrow they want to be president. And you heard over the weekend with some of the tributes and some of the people that worked for H.W. and some of his admirers talking about just how prepared he was to be president. And I think that is a contrast with a lot of the leadership we have today. And you also heard some of them say over the weekend that we may never see another president take office as prepared to do the job as George H.W. Bush was.
Hmm. Well, a lot of good themes there, and we're going to pick them up at the end of the hour. I want to move on and talk about some of the big stories that you folks are going to be covering this week. And Arlene, actually, let me stay with you, because on Friday there was talk about a possible government shutdown over President Trump's demand for funding for the U.S. border wall. But the death of former President Bush appears to have pushed that confrontation off. Where do we stand with that?
That's right. This coming Friday is the deadline for some government funding to expire, and the threat of a shutdown was looming overhead because some of the funding has to do with the Department of Homeland Security and immigration and the border, and the president is still pushing for maximum funding for the border wall that he promised during the campaign and has not yet been able to get the full amount of funding that he wants from Congress. But on the flight back from the G20 summit in Argentina, he was asked about that, and he said that he would be willing to sort of push that deadline off maybe a week or two in light of the fact that President Bush has died, and this week in Washington is a week of mourning, and you don't want to really be fighting over issues like that when you're trying to remember a statesman like George W. Bush. And there's some sentiment for this in Congress also. Hmm. The hiccup right now, I think, is whether it will be a one-week extension or a two-week extension.
All right. Well, that's a confrontation that obviously we'll come back to in a week or two.
Or two.
Or two, yeah. So let's move on and talk about trade with China and this temporary truce in the trade war. At the G20 meeting in Buenos Aires over the weekend, President Trump had dinner with Chinese President Xi Jinping, and the U.S. agreed to postpone its threat to increase tariffs on Chinese goods from 10% to 25% for 3 months while the two sides try to settle their differences. Trump tweeted out, quote, "It's an incredible deal. If it happens, it goes down as one of the largest deals ever made." Dave Lawler, love to bring you in on this. Is it an incredible deal, one of the largest ever made? What's your view on what happened in Buenos Aires?
So far, we have quite a limited deal. It's 90 days, no new tariffs. The tariffs that are in place remain in place. The idea is that they can work towards some sort of grand bargain that would include issues like intellectual property theft, China's unfair trade practices. It seems very unlikely to me that we're going to get to that point in 90 days. So the question is whether Trump is backing off this China trade war. My colleague spoke to some China hawks who say they think he might be spooked by the markets, and also the idea that the domestic political situation, including the Mueller probe, is so intense that he needs short-term victories like this, and he can't afford to be fighting an all-out trade war with China. So it's unclear if when we revisit this in 90 days or even before then, if President Trump is going to be as sort of hard line with China, or if we've seen the peak of the trade war. It's unclear to me so far which is the case.
Darlene, what's your point of view there from the White House? Is the president backing off the trade war with China, or what's your view?
I think it's a sort of a situation where it remains to be seen a little bit. Mm. There is this 90-day window, and talks are supposed to continue. Both sides are supposed to keep talking to try to resolve this situation. But I think the president, at the end of 90 days, if he feels China hasn't done enough or bought enough agricultural products, he would be very open to ratcheting up the tariffs that were supposed to go up on January 1, which now won't, because now they've reached this temporary truce.
Let's go to Brad, who's calling from Waterville, Maine. Go ahead, Brad. You're on the air. Thanks so much for the call.
Hi, Anthony. Glad to have the opportunity to join the program.
What's on your mind?
I think that the Trump administration is starting to realize that maybe the tariffs aren't working the way they want them to. There are a lot of manufacturers that are considering moving their productions overseas now, and I think the big announcement from General Motors probably highlighted that more than anything else.
Interesting. Jeff Begays, what do you think about what Brad said? I mean, is there a sense, as you look at this, that maybe this hard line on trade with China isn't working out for President Trump very well at home? What's your view?
Listen, the fact that they have this 90 days to work toward a broader agreement is obviously a positive thing for the Trump administration. Wall Street seems to like it. But the reality is there were some major losses in the midterm elections. And whether that had a role here, whether the president felt like he needed a win. Perhaps that was at play here. What we've seen at the G20 is even though the White House is touting this agreement to more talks, you know, we've seen instances where the president seems frustrated. In mm-hmm. fact, his audio was captured where he said as he was leaving a stage after a photo op, "Get me out of here." You know, so he seems to be frustrated. And typically when you reach this type of agreement that Wall Street seems to embrace, typically a President Trump, you would think would be happy about that. But for some reason, he seems frustrated by something at the G20 or perhaps here at home. But to the question, you know, he needs a win, and I think they know that.
Dave Lawler, we've got about 30 seconds left in the break, but is there agreement between Washington and Beijing about what exactly these two leaders agreed to? Because as I'm reading these articles, it seems like they sort of both have different ideas about what's going on here.
There's a big gap here, and actually Bloomberg did a good job. They put the statement side to side, issue by issue. There are issues that the Chinese addressed that the U.S. did not address. There are issues that they discussed differently. So it's unclear if that is a good foundation on which to build a broader deal if they can't agree on what they've agreed to so far.
All right, listeners, we're talking about what's to come in the week ahead. You can join the conversation. Mexico has a new president. Will he pay for President Trump's border wall? What's the future of our relationship with our southern neighbor? We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're looking ahead to the week's biggest news stories. You can join the conversation. What are you watching for in former FBI Director James Comey's closed-door testimony before Congress? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm talking with Axios World News editor Dave Lawler, Associated Press White House reporter Darlene Superville, and CBS News Justice and Homeland Security correspondent Jeff Begays. And folks, let's take one more call about China and U.S. and this trade war. Dan is calling from Tampa, Florida. Dan, thanks so much for the call. What's on your mind?
Hi, Anthony. Nothing. I just want to comment. I think it's fantastic. I think it's about time that we got tough with China. You know, China does what China does, and that is use all means necessary to get ahead. And, you know, to our benefit by getting cheap products, both literally and price-wise cheap. And, you know, it's cost us these low-level jobs, what people call low-level jobs. Some people call it a way of putting food on the table. We need more of these jobs in this country. So if we get some back, great. But otherwise, it's tit for tat. I mean, they're charging us incredibly high tariffs on our products, typically. And we have quite low tariffs on their products. So why not raise tariffs? And if, you know, and I believe the reason why it hasn't been done to this point is because it's tough. Because yep. People get affected. Prices go up for some people. And it takes a tough president to do that. And Donald Trump doesn't care if you don't like him. That's why I voted for him.
All right, Dan, we really appreciate your point of view and a vote in favor of getting tough with China there. Darlene, Jeff, Dave, I want to move on and talk about the U.S.-Mexico border, the future of U.S.-Mexico relations. Mexico's new president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, was sworn in over the weekend. U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will be holding talks with the incoming foreign minister, Marcelo Ebrard, in Houston on Thursday. Darlene, I want to ask you, what's the focus of these talks?
Certainly one of the focus of the talks will be what's going on right now at the border.
Yeah.
You've had the president very agitated over thousands of migrants from Central America making their way to the U.S. through Mexico and complaining that Mexico is not doing enough or hasn't been doing enough to stop them. There are also issues about the drug flow, drug trafficking across the border, as well possibly as the issue of the border wall the president wants to build, which was a sticking point in relations with the former Mexican president, Enrique Peña Nieto, and is sure to be another strain on relations with Mexico as the new administration takes over.
Right. Jeff Begays, do you expect the sort of tenor of relationships between relationship between the U.S. and Mexico, particularly over this border wall issue, to change at all with a new administration coming in Mexico?
I think the tension will remain, especially as DHS has now asked for troop deployment to be extended there through the end of January. Citing the ongoing threat at the southern border. And so DHS wants the number of troops there to remain at about 4,000. And this is something that, leading up to the midterm elections, people called a political stunt on that the president was obviously talking about and championing. So, you know, with the troops at the border, with the caravan still an issue for this administration, I think that the tension will remain where it has been.
Yeah. Dave Lawler, what's your view on this? Big issues remain, of course, between these two countries, the migrant issue, trade, crime, the border wall. What does the inauguration of a new president in Mexico mean to the future of U.S.-Mexico relations right now? Improvement or more of the same?
I'm fascinated to see how López Obrador plays this, right? He's a really interesting political figure. He's a populist. His first act after becoming president was opening up the old presidential palace to the public. He's not going to live there. He's a champion for the poor in Mexico. He's the first leftist president there in some time. And the question is whether he's also a pragmatist. That was his reputation when he was mayor of Mexico City, but he's also got this kind of revolutionary aura around him. So when President Trump makes the kinds of comments that he's prone to make about Mexicans and about immigrants, will he rise to the bait? What will his response be? I think that's going to go a long way to determine how the relations between those two leaders are. But at the moment, you know, the fact that Pompeo is meeting with the Mexican foreign minister and they're discussing a potential deal on asylum seekers at the border signals that he's starting from a point of thinking he can cooperate with the Trump administration.
Let's take a call on this subject. Len is calling from China, Maine. Len, it's good to have you on the show. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Real short message. It's hard to fathom how our legislators have let the issue of the border go on for so long, because it's causing great strife for the people that think they can come here and wish to come here, but there are laws that they have to obey, and the people that live on the other side. So it's been total mayhem for 10 years. And I think somehow I think that the people that should be held accountable for this are the people that have been in the Senate and the Congress for a long time, and they've pushed this issue back, and it's really sad.
All right, Len, I get it, and I thank you for your call. Darlene, speak to sort of Len's point here, and to what extent, I suppose, the folks in the White House are still concerned with that point of view that is, you know, a lot of folks out there remain frustrated by the situation at the border and the need for stronger border security. How do you think this is playing out right now in the White House?
Well, right. Immigration and reforming the system has been an issue for a long, long time. And it's one of those issues where everyone wants to do something, but no one can ever agree on what to do or how to do it, that sort of thing. It's one of these perpetual issues that just gets kicked around Washington year after year after year. And in the White House, there is that sense that something needs to be done. You all have heard the president blame Democrats for not supplying the votes for the border wall, to change the immigration policy, so on and so forth. They're resisting some of the things that he wants to do. And it's another one of those, it remains to be seen whether they will be able to put their heads together now that Congress is changing next year, the makeup of Congress is changing, or the control of Congress is changing on some level. The House will be controlled by Democrats. Republicans will still have the Senate, and whether they can do anything then. But again, you run into this cycle where we just finished with the midterm elections, and now we're already moving full speed ahead into the 2020 presidential election, and there are all sorts of pressures that are going to come into play in terms of trying to do something with this issue. So I keep saying it remains to be seen, but it really does remain to be seen.
Jeff, I want to ask you, in terms of it remaining to be seen, how do you see this playing out for the rest of this year? And as Darlene mentioned, you know, as soon as the midterms are over, boom, we're right into the sort of the next general election cycle. Maybe not this week, but soon enough.
No, you can already feel like we're in that next general election cycle here in Washington. I mean, this is another area where President Trump needs a win, because immigration is one big reason why he got elected in the first place. Mm. And what we will see over the next year or so is whether this tougher rhetoric on immigration is the answer in terms of accomplishing the goals that he has set, or will it take a more compassionate approach, the kind of approach that George W. Bush advocated for when he was president? And so I think that's what we'll see in the next year. What approach works here with the incoming administration in Mexico to solve this chronic problem at the southern border?
Esteemed colleagues, I want to move on and talk about the meeting testimony from former FBI Director James Comey. He'll testify before Congress behind closed doors later this week. This would be before the House Judiciary Committee, and focus on the FBI's conduct around the probe into possible Russian interference in the 2016 election. Jeff, let me stick with you. Tell us more about the focus of this and the significance of this appearance by Comey.
The Republicans in Congress are intent on getting more information out of James Comey about how he handled the Russia investigation and also how he handled the Clinton private email server investigation. And after all this time of testimony on Capitol Hill and James Comey's book tour, it's hard to believe that anything new will come out of this testimony. What we saw over the last couple of days was James Comey going to court with his attorneys, trying to prevent this from happening because he wanted it to happen in an open forum, but they came to an agreement over the weekend where the transcript will be released within 24 hours and he's able to talk about the testimony. But even with that, it is really hard to believe that we're going to hear something new. And is this Republicans just trying to score political points before they lose control of the House in January?
Interesting. Darlene, what do you see as the significance of this hearing? Of course, the last time, and we're not going to see this hearing, but we will, I gather, have access to the transcript after it happens. The last time former FBI Director James Comey testified before Congress, it was a riveting moment. This will obviously be less riveting because folks won't see it. But how are you looking at this?
Well, I agree with Jeff that it's sort of hard, very hard to imagine that anything new will be revealed by bringing the former director up to the Hill and having him testify again for hours. And it just makes me, you know, sort of wonder what the whole point of that exercise is. We haven't heard too much from the White House on that. We haven't heard anything on the White House from that, as a matter of fact. Mm. So it doesn't seem – his appearance later this week does not seem to be on the radar here at all.
Let's take a call on this. Jack is calling from Acton, Massachusetts. Jack, thanks so much for the call. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to observe that we've already seen – the American public, that is – that the House committees that are controlled by the Republicans have been careful about – controlling the testimonies that they've collected from witnesses and releasing information from those testimonies in a very selective fashion in order to suit particular narratives, some of which they have manufactured. So the exercise of bringing James Comey back for testimony seems to be another one of those efforts in which they want to bolster the case for the illegality of the investigation by Mueller into the Trump-Russia work. And they're using the effort to discredit James Comey as a tool in that exercise. That is why I think Director Comey wanted to have the testimony made public in whole. And I wouldn't be surprised to see the transcript released only partially or highly redacted so that the Republicans can continue to serve their objectives with it.
All right, Jekyll, I appreciate the call. And on that point, let's hear from New York Democratic Congressman Gerald Nadler, the ranking member and incoming chairman of the new Congress, of the new committee. He told NBC's Meet the Press yesterday that even though the committee chairman, Virginia Congressman Bob Goodlatte, said he would videotape it and provide a transcript within 24 hours, that's still not enough.
The Republicans in this particular investigation have a history of having these in-camera interviews and then selectively leaking portions of the interview to give distorted view to the public of what happened. Let Comey testify in public. There's no military secrets here. He wants to testify. He ought to be able to. We ought to have accountability and openness to the American public.
So, Jeff Begay, speak to that point and to our caller's point, this idea, this risk that Republicans will use this testimony selectively to make their case.
Well, and we've seen that in the past, especially with the House-led investigations where they defy the U.S. intelligence community and its conclusions and seem to come to their own conclusions about what happened during the 2016 campaign. But the reason why James Comey in an open forum would have been so problematic is because he is skilled at providing this kind of testimony. He's an attorney, but also obviously spent time as the FBI director where he was routinely called up to the Hill to testify. And so the Republicans knew that getting him in that open forum where he has been riveting TV in the past would be problematic. And so the Democrats, what they are concerned about is this selective leak of information that would then benefit the Trump administration. But I suspect, having covered James Comey as I did for 2 years while he was at the FBI, you know, I suspect they will, even behind closed doors, have a hard time painting him into a corner, allowing them to then release some sort of information that appears to help the president and then further, in their view, damage James Comey's reputation.
Hmm. Folks, in the minute and a half or so that we have left, let me sort of whip around the horn really quickly and just ask you all, what else are you watching this week? What's the story that listeners may not be thinking about or may be thinking about that you're looking forward to focusing on? Darlene, let me start with you.
One thing that I'm watching out for this week is whether or not the White House will admit defeat and withdraw the nomination of Thomas Farr to be a federal judge in North Carolina. He's run into some roadblocks up in the Senate, and his fate seemed to be sealed when Senator Tim Scott from South Carolina said that he would not vote for his confirmation. Senator Scott, along with Senator Flake and all of the Democrats in opposition, the votes are not there to confirm Mr. Farr, who has somewhat of a checkered past in terms of race relations and civil rights issues that make him unacceptable to the folks up on the Hill who are opposing him. So the next step would be for the White House to formally withdraw his nomination, and that's one of the things I'll be looking for this week.
Dave Lawler, what about you?
I'll be looking to Hamburg, Germany, where Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Party is going to gather to pick her successor as leader of the party. She says she's giving up leadership of the party after a string of bad election results, but will stay on as chancellor through 2021. I think what happens in this election will determine whether she's able to do that and how long she's going to be in the job.
All right. Well, another big week ahead in the news. Dave Lawler, Associate Editor for World News at Axios. We appreciate your time today. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And Darlene Superville, White House reporter for the Associated Press. Darlene, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Jeff Pagés, Justice and Homeland Security correspondent for CBS News, author of the 2018 book, Kompromat, How Russia Undermined American Democracy. Jeff, always great to have you. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
Listeners, stay with us. Coming up, we're going to remember President George H.W. Bush, who died this weekend at the age of 94. We'll be right back. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks.
America is never wholly herself unless she is engaged in high moral principle. We as a people have such a purpose today. It is to make kinder the face of the nation and gentler the face of the world.
Nearly 30 years after his inaugural address in which he promised a kinder, gentler nation, former President George H.W. Bush died Friday at the age of 94. For the rest of the hour, we're going to look back on the life and legacy of the nation's 41st president. You can join the conversation. How do you remember the first President Bush, a formidable force in foreign policy, someone who failed to deliver on his domestic promises? Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me here in the studio is presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, a professor of history at Rice University in Bush 41's adopted hometown of Houston, Texas. Douglas Brinkley, it's great to have you, and thanks so much for coming in person. It's great to meet you face to face.
Well, wonderful to be here. Thank you.
Also joining us from Austin, Texas is Mark Updegrove, president and CEO of the Lyndon Baines Johnson Foundation, presidential historian and author of the 2017 book, The Last Republican, Inside the Extraordinary Relationship Between George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. Mark Updegrove, great to have you. Welcome to On Point.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Anthony.
Douglas, let me start with you. Just a really basic question. How are you remembering Bush 41?
Oh, I'm remembering what an incredible job he did on U.S. foreign policy. The fact of the matter is, you know, it was a dangerous time. We talk now about the Berlin Wall coming down, being torn down, but things could have mayhem could have occurred. Bush very calmly dealt with the wall coming down. He dealt with German reunification. By 1991, we had the breakup of the Soviet Union. Everything was being unspooled and unraveling in the Balkans and the former Soviet republics. And he very calmly made sure that there was stability, that there was such a thing as a transatlantic alliance between the United States and the NATO countries. And he reassured Russia that they were going to be welcomed in the family of countries. And he did an amazing job of corralling loose nuclear weapons, keeping nuclear weapons out of rogue hands, which could have been very easy to have happened during those kind of hurly-burly years when the communism came to an end.
Mm. Mark, I'd like to come to you with the same question. Douglas Brinkley there talking about Bush as a really sort of able steward of the post-Cold War era.
There's no question. I think that's the dominant part of his legacy. We had in place from 1989 to 1993 the right man, particularly given his diplomatic facility. He was the right person to be the leader of the free world during the breakup of the Soviet Union. He had those skills. It also is worth remembering, though, two other things. I think before he died, there was no American, perhaps no citizen of the world, who had seen more history firsthand than George H.W. Bush. He was on the front lines of World War II in Congress during the latter part of the LBJ years and building a great society. He was a special envoy to China before its opening, when China began its rise in the world. He was the head of the GOP during the Watergate years, and would go on to become the vice president during the Reagan years, of course, the president, and would ultimately become the president of the 43rd president of the United States, or excuse me, the father of the 43rd president of the United States. So I think that that is an important part of his legacy, too, the amount of history he took part in. And finally, just being the patriarch of the Bush political dynasty, being, again, the father of the 43rd president, and perhaps the patriarch of a family that does so much more in the area of politics.
Mm. And I want to talk about sort of what happened to that Bush family dynasty. But I want to ask you both, and I'll come back to you, Douglas Brinkley. You know, much has been made of how he called for a kinder, gentler nation. But he was also capable of being a pretty tough partisan warrior. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But to what extent did he make good on that commitment to create a kinder, gentler nation? It certainly stands in stark contrast to the tone of the contemporary political discourse, I guess.
Well, Mark just gave us a great run through his resume and then also his character. He really did want it to be a kinder, gentler nation. However, he was a politician.
Yep.
And he was operating out of Harris County, Texas. He ran for the Republican Party when the South was very Democratic, eventually got traction. And in order to be a leader in the Republican Party, you've got to do some things that aren't kind and aren't gentle. We see that most famously with the hiring of Lee Atwater in the campaign in 1988 against Michael Dukakis. And although I think for the rest of his life, 41 was embarrassed by the Willie Horton ad and said it came from a farm organization. It's not from home base.
And let me just jump in because I just want to remind for listeners who might not recall or might not know, the Willie Horton ad was a really tough political ad that tried to link Michael Dukakis, who was running for president against George H.W. Bush, to link him to Willie Horton, who was a furloughed black man who was involved in a murder, and the case was basically to create a lot of fear around programs like this and tar Michael Dukakis, right?
Exactly, and yeah. Some saw it as a racist ad.
Yep.
And that's not the brand that we remember 41 for. He wants to be remembered as somebody who did care about affirmative action, who did give African Americans top positions. The first black Surgeon General came from 41. You know, he worked with Colin Powell, Condoleezza Rice. He picked Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, which should have been a big moment, a new Thurgood Marshall coming to the Supreme Court, except Clarence Thomas blew up on him because of the Anita Hill and sexual harassment allegations and the fact that many Americans, even some centrist Republicans, thought that Clarence Thompson was too much of a right-wing ideologue. The point is you can't come out of politics without having some sharp elbows.
Right.
But what tells you about his character, in my mind, is when he loses, when he lost to Bill Clinton in 1992, how gracious he was to Bill Clinton, not just the famous note he left behind, but his concession speech and the fact that in later years he was able to work on, you know, Katrina relief and other humanitarian causes with the young whippersnapper from Arkansas who beat him.
Yeah.
I think that speaks largely to what a marvelous character he had.
Let's go to Bruce, who's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Bruce, go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks so much for the call.
You're welcome. I guess I feel quite different than Professor Brinkley about the Willie Horton ad, and sort of it really sort of seared my consciousness at how that ad stoked racial fears by using white supremacist strategies, playing on these age-old, long-created notions, as the professor would know, about black men as criminals.
No, I'm agreement with you. That's what I was agreeing with.
Let me finish, professor. Yeah.
No, but you can finish, Bruce, but I do want to say that that's exactly what Professor Brinkley was expressing, was concern about that ad. But go ahead and finish your point.
You're missing my point. Let me finish my point for sure, because what I'm saying is that's what stuck. And that's what sticks. And all that you're talking about in terms of his character and his thousand points of lights and a kinder, gentler nation was trumped, if you will, by that ad, which Republicans have played upon and continue to play upon, thinking about Trump's obvious racist caricatures, playing on that ad with Luis Bracamontes, for example, about the California deputies. That was horrifying that they keep playing the same card. That started with Willie Horton and long before, I should add, as the professor of history knows, and that's what sticks and that's what's significant in my view.
Well, Bruce, thanks so much for the call. Douglas Brinkley, respond to that.
As I said, I have a lot of concern about that Willie Horton ad. I think it was racist. And I think Lee Atwater ran a very dirty campaign. When you talk about dark moments in presidential history, I put the Willie Horton ad very high. We saw in the midterms here President Trump doing that caravan ad and dealing with, another different kind of racist ad about somebody from Latin American, being a bully and murdering people and put it in. And even Fox News pulled that. So I think that we don't, when somebody dies, we just don't want to talk about the high points. We want to remember things that they did badly. And I think that Willie Horton ad is the low ebb of Bush's life.
You know, Mark Updegrove, I'd love to get you to comment on this, but I'll just sort of preface the question by I was reading quotes from Michael Dukakis, who sort of said, obviously I had some significant differences with George H.W. Bush, but he called him a very wise and thoughtful man. But chime in on this conversation about the significance of that Willie Horton ad, I guess, and what it ushered in terms of political warfare.
Yeah, I think Doug articulated it very well, and he mentioned the sharp elbows of politics. And in talking with George Bush, he often invoked that phrase. He would say, when you're in the heat of battle, the elbows get sharp. And you can see in his remarkable career, him toggle back between political expedience and kind of fighting with his conscience to do the right thing. And a great example of that as it relates to race goes back to his days in the 1960s when he was running for the Senate unsuccessfully and for Congress successfully. In 1964, he campaigns for the Senate against Ralph Yarborough, the incumbent senator here in Texas, and he ultimately loses, but he comes out against the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And he does so because he knows it's the right thing to do for constituents. He knows that it's profoundly unpopular in Texas. And so he exploits that vote from Ralph Yarborough. But he goes on to become a congressman. And in 1968, when Martin Luther King is assassinated, the Fair Housing Act is proposed, and he has to vote on that. It's wildly unpopular, like the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was, but he supports it, as a matter of conscience. Huh. And he does so at his political peril. Comes back to Houston and talks to a very angry room full of constituents in a high school gymnasium. And he starts talking about why he has made that vote, has supported the Fair Housing Act as an act of conscience. And he ends up getting a standing ovation from the crowd. And it sort of is the political education of George Herbert Walker Bush. He would still have struggles between what was the right thing to do politically and the right thing to do as a matter of conscience. But I really do believe the very fact that he was talking about high moral principle and thinking about it throughout the course of his career speaks volumes about George Herbert Walker Bush.
I was looking and really impressed by a piece this morning in the New York Times by John Meacham. He wrote Destiny of Power, The American Odyssey of George H.W. Bush. And he describes this meeting between Bush and Newt Gingrich right after Newt Gingrich came to Congress. And Bush, in conversation with Gingrich, finally says, I'm worried that your idealism will get in the way of what I think is sound governance. And that seems to sum up so much Bush's view of governing and how it would lose out to Gingrich's style of sort of partisan combat and warfare, which in a way has stuck with us ever since. What do you think, Douglas?
Well, Newt Gingrich's famous contract, with America's 1994, and Bush lost in 1992. So Gingrich is saying to Bush also, you have a losing strategy. What was the problems that Bush faced in 92? Was it Bill Clinton only? No. He was attacked by Pat Buchanan from the far right, that Bush was not taking the cultural issues of America seriously enough. It was sort of a pitchfork campaign by Buchanan against Bush. And then Ross Perot, the Texas billionaire, runs a third-party campaign, anti-NAFTA campaign, the sucking sound you hear of the jobs going to Mexico. And so by 92, 3, 4, when you're looking at who George Herbert Walker Bush is, he represents the center, maybe slightly center-right of the America's Republican Party, but the party's moving away from him. They're seeing Bushism as failure, and that the new – you have to out-Reagan Reagan. And that's what Newt Gingrich tries to do. And then you see George W. Bush, the son, try to be more Reagan-esque than like his own father.
Mark Updegrove, he was the last World War II generation president. How did that link to that moment in history shape his worldview and his record as president?
Yeah, John F. Kennedy came in proclaiming that the torch had been passed to a new generation of Americans, and it would stay with that generation, what we now call the greatest generation from 1961, Kennedy's presidency through George H.W. Bush's presidency in 1993. You know, he was shot down in World War II in the Pacific Theater. He was a naval aviator, and his plane went down off of the island of Chichijima. He lost two crewmates as the plane crashed into the Pacific. And he was on a raft paddling furiously away from the island where he would have been captured and probably killed. And out of nowhere comes the USS Finback, a submarine, a U.S. submarine, which picks him up. It's absolutely miraculous. And he thought that day and throughout the life, the course of his remarkable life, that his life that day was spared and there was some kind of destiny that awaited him. And I don't think he ever took life for granted or his role in the world for granted after that. He always put service above self. And I think that that incident in the Pacific Theater shaped him as much as any in his life.
Well, Mark Updegrove, the head of the LBJ Foundation in Austin, Texas, and author of the 2017 book, The Last Republicans, Inside the Extraordinary Relationship Between George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. We appreciate your time today. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Anthony.
And Douglas Brinkley, presidential historian and professor of history at Rice University. Thank you, Douglas Brinkley, for coming in and helping us to remember former President George H.W. Bush, who died this past Friday at the age of 94. Douglas, thank you.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Thanks for listening. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.